Hello, and a warm welcome back to Brailcast, connecting the dots for Brailleists everywhere. And in this episode, we're going to be in conversation with Scott Erickson. Regular Brailcast listeners will know that I visited Australia and New Zealand last year, and we featured a number of interviews from that trip in the weeks that followed. But one interview that we didn't feature at the time was with Scott Erickson, an Australian assistive technology expert, musician, and all-round Braille enthusiast. As a musician, he's an accomplished jazz and classical pianist, and regularly accompanies other musicians in concerts, exams, and recordings. His technology career began when a UK company, TNT Consultancy, expanded its operations into Australia in the late 2000s. After being the figurehead of that operation for several years, he enjoyed positions at Quantum RLV, Pacific Vision International, Humanware, and the National Disability Insurance Agency. In this fascinating conversation, we discover more about Scott's musical and technological career, the part that Braille plays in his life and work, and his perspective on the future of Braille technology. I started by asking him to describe his blindness journey.
I was born early, 15 weeks early, so I could see apparently for the first 5 months, and then I was given essentially too much oxygen, and the fluctuations and things caused the blood vessels to burst in my eyes. I think we're very lucky in this time that we live with technology and Braille.
And Braille, I guess it's one of those things, because you were blind pretty much since birth, Braille was just always kind of there in the background. Do you remember learning Braille, or has it always just kind of been there?
Pretty much always been there. I went to a blind school, it's called St. Lucy's School for the Blind in Sydney. And they had these wonderful taxi pick you up each day, and they picked up a few of us and drove us there. The school had not many students. It was probably six to a class. So it was a nice small sort of atmosphere. There were about 24 to 27 students any one time. And it meant that we could focus on those specific things like blindness skills and Braille and O&M and all that kind of thing. We would have private lessons and class lessons for Braille. Everyone had Perkins. And we also had other devices that were around in the early 90s. We had a library which had a huge amount of Braille books that we could borrow. I left St. Lucy's when I was about 10 and went to mainstream primary school for year 5 and year 6, and then into mainstream high school way through to the rest of my schooling. And of course, I had Braille there as well.
People often ask me, by what age did you know grade 2? And I always have to stop and say, well, I don't really know by what age I knew grade 2. What I do know, the benchmark for me, is my Key Stage 2 SATs, which is statutory assessment tests. I know that by the time I was about 11 and I was doing my Key Stage 2 SATs, I was doing full grade 2 Braille. But I don't know exactly when I picked up the whole grade 2 code. But can you really remember by what point you would consider yourself to be fluent in grade 2?
Probably 9, 10, something like that, maybe 11. I can't think of learning grade 1 and grade 2 separately. I think it was all just you learned how to spell the words, and then you would learn the contractions, and you would just realize that that was the way that we wrote the words in Braille. And we did have weekly spelling tests, and we'd be given basically a page with the 20 words, and there would be the word uncontracted. Then there would be a line of dot threes, and then a bit over to the right, there would be the contraction. And at the end of the week, you not only had to know the contraction, you also had to know how to spell the word, because it's all very well to know that P is for people, but if you can't spell people well, you're in trouble. And that was sort of when I was 8 or 9, and then it would just keep happening. Because by the time I got to mainstream school, I just had to know how to spell. You weren't going to have private Braille lessons in mainstream school.
No, it was exactly the same over here. And I remember those spelling tests too. And I feel like they've gone out of fashion now. And I think that's a bit of a shame. And did you read much? Because that was the other way that I learned contractions, was just not so much reading novels, but reading hymn books and things like that, and coming across words I'd never seen before in forms I'd never seen before. And I just went, oh, well, that must mean that then.
Yeah, I did. I would do quite a lot of reading. I'd also request books to be brailled. So by the time I got to mainstream school, I wanted to read the books that the other kids were reading. So if they didn't exist in Braille, I'd try and get them. And if I couldn't get them in audio, just as a fallback option to be able to at least talk about the books with them, they would get Braille for me, which was great. Although I remember reading, I don't know if you remember the R.L. Stine books, the Goosebumps books, but they were a big hit for the kids and I wanted to read some of them. So I got them Braille and the first one turned up and it was 4 volumes. I'm like, okay, I'll get through this. And it took me a while, but everybody else was taking just as long to get through them because they'd read a chapter a night. I'd read, well, maybe not quite a chapter, but even still, you know, and I didn't feel so bad at taking so long to get through them. But as you say, you learn things from just reading as much as you can. And I think even now, I still read things where I go, oh, that looks interesting. And that's a word I've never seen. And nowadays, I think we come across a lot more things that we haven't seen before. So it's a matter of if you know the code, you should be able to be fluent. And I think the key is being able to read aloud. That's something that I don't believe I did enough of. I can read Braille perfectly fine, but when I read aloud, I find I'm not as confident. And I think that's something that's really important, to have that opportunity to read aloud and to really be able to be fluent and not feel like you're struggling.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. My Braille reading is very much born out of singing. And so I read a line and then I sing the line and I read the next line and I sing the next line. And so it's very stilted because I pause at the end of each line and I can't get myself out of the habit of doing that.
Yeah, I do a bit of that too. When I was 10, I started going to the National Braille Music Camp in Mittagong. It's still going. I went to 16 of them, both as a student and a teacher, and it gave us an opportunity to focus on Braille music. I met some great people there, some great mentors, some great friends, people that are still friends. And something like that is great for kids. There's now several offshoot, if you like, camps that focus on Braille and Braille music and Braille music with tech and various things like that that are happening around the country. And there's even a Braille music retreat in New Zealand. So an opportunity for people who really want to learn that side of the Braille code. And I think that's important to have those opportunities. And I'm certainly grateful to be able to have gone for so many years and to build up those skills. I mean, it's all very well to go to these camps and spend a week away and hang out with your friends. But the trick is when you come back, it's about focusing on your Braille or your Braille music or whatever the camp might entail. If you don't practice them, you're not going to be able to remember them and commit them to memory. It's like songs you were talking about before, being able to read words and lines. But I find I keep the Braille as a guide, even though I've sung it so many times that I just remember it.
I'm curious about how you learnt these specialized codes. You were saying that when you went to mainstream school, oh, well, you're not going to get one-to-one Braille lessons anymore. But there are specialist codes, not only the music code, but also the maths code and the science code. And I don't know whether there was computer code and whether you actually needed to use it particularly, but how did you learn those specialized codes?
Music code, I started learning when I was 9, and they wouldn't teach the music to you unless you could already read Braille. There were two wonderful teachers, one's no longer with us and one is still around, who had been teaching me piano through the school, and they said, we'd like to teach you Braille music. And I remember looking at this thermoform book and thinking, oh my God, what is this? This doesn't make any sense. And I had a half an hour lesson with the two of them. And it was really funny because there was no piano. We were sitting in the library and they just showed me this book and they're like, so let's explain it. I'm like, okay. And then the year after, when I was 10, which was my last year at St. Lucy's in 94, I went to my first music camp and I was just amazed. I remember sitting down the first on the Sunday morning and everyone grabbed their book and we turned to a piece that had no words and we started singing and everyone had perfect pitch and it was amazing just to sit there and sing. We're all just making music with just these books. And for the first time, it was a real eye-opening thing to be able to just be with other people who were reading Braille.
Yes. And I think that's important, isn't it? There's something very special about being with other musicians, whether they're blind or sighted.
Well, definitely. Music is a universal language. I like to think of Braille as a language, to be honest. And the reason I say that is because Braille is blind people's language, you could say. I mean, I know it's not strictly a language, but I like to think of it as one because it is how we are literate.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of what I was coming on to, is that it's great to be with musicians. It's great to be with Braillies, because there's a certain thing when a bunch of Braille people get in the same room. And I agree, it's not a language. I would never call it a language. It is a code, but it's a code that so few people understand. And I think that's very sad. But it does mean that Braillies who hang around with each other, there's a certain thing. And so when you combine those two together, when you combine Braille and music, you've got a bunch of people who are in the zone because they're with other people who are like them, but also extremely disciplined because you're all learning the same thing and you're all studying the same discipline. And that must have been really formative in terms of actually learning Braille music and going on to some of the musical things that you do now.
It certainly was. And later on, you know, to be able to teach and guide students and mentor them, I still help people out now when people ask questions. And you got to have the attitude of no question is a stupid question, because so many things change in the world of Braille. And I don't mean the code, I just mean aspects change. Like there might be a sign that changes, there might be a rule. It's important to be open-minded, and you want people to see you as a mentor and somebody to look to be able to ask questions of, because knowledge is power. Sharing knowledge is important for the younger generation, but also for people who just want to know more.
Yes, absolutely. And actually having people who do this stuff is just incredible, really. I've talked to you about the sort of things that you do with music. You do a lot of piano playing now, but not just piano playing for fun, but you actually get paid money to play the piano, right?
I do. So I went to Pittwater High, which was a high school just not far from my house. I loved the fact that I could walk there with my cane. And what was interesting was if you walk there, it took me 25 minutes. But if I convinced my dear mother to drive me, it took 3. So you can imagine at 8:45, I'd be like, yeah, I need to go to school. And she'd just drive me down there on the way to somewhere, because why would you walk 25 minutes when you can be driven and just take as much stuff as you want with you? And of course, with our heavy bags, I'm sure you had this too. We had so many Braille books we had to carry. But I had a lot of opportunity to play piano. The main teachers that were responsible are both still around. One retired this year, and I went to see her final show that she put on at the school. So I had lots of opportunities in school to accompany students and play for shows. I played for several musicals and things like that, West Side Story. And I'll be honest, I didn't actually use Braille to do all of it. I used it for some, but it taught me a lot about how to perform collaboratively with others. I mainly did jazz. I played in the big band. I would also, as I said, play for shows and play for other company, mainly singers, but also other instruments as well. And after school, I went to the Sydney Conservatorium studying jazz. You had to audition, got in with 2 other piano players, and spent 4 years studying there. I was lucky enough to release a couple of albums. One was while I was at the con, and the other one was later on, wrote some of my own stuff. And I did use Braille to write the music, mainly for my own benefit, because the others couldn't read it. I played gigs around Sydney. I still play around Sydney and do gigs. That gave me a lot of mentors. I went to New York for 6 weeks and got to work with some great musicians there. And every night I went to a gig. I don't think there was a single night that I was actually at home. But in saying that, this was all about my ears. So yes, there were aspects where I used Braille. I would obviously get Braille for a lot of the classes where you didn't have to play. But I would also, as part of the course, per year you had 20 pieces you had to learn, 10 that were compulsory and 10 that were just good to learn each year. So in total about 80 tunes. I got them all Brailled, which you would say why when jazz is so much based on improvisation. And that was because I wanted to know what the class was all reading. And sure, I could have grabbed a recording and listened to it, and I did. But the way they were playing, it was different recording. And I'm like, well, I want to know what is written so that I'm playing it the same way they are. But also it gave me understanding of how the pieces were written, how some of them were organized and whatever. Even for my final honors recital, I did some really difficult music and I actually got it all Brailled, because you had to write your thesis and program notes and they had to have musical examples. And of course, yeah, I could play it, But having that there in Braille was a really great thing because it meant I know why these guys who are playing with me are finding this a bit tricky because I can see why rhythmically this is so challenging. When you hear it, you just copy it and figure it out until you've got it. But reading it is so much better. In saying that, I also did classical piano as well before that. And you start off with all the written stuff. I played Bach and Chopin and Mozart and Beethoven and all that sort of stuff. And I still occasionally pull the odd sonata out and attempt to relearn some of them. My passion is improvisation and jazz, but you've got to keep an open mind with any music, really.
There's been a lot of development recently in Braille music and Braille music technology. There was a time for a long time where if you wanted to do computerized Braille music, your only option really was the Goodfeel suite. And that's changed now, thanks to the Daisy Music Braille project. Have you used much of that technology? Have you been using MuseScore and SoundMyBraille and MakeBraille? And what's your take on all of that?
MakeBraille I haven't used because originally I think it was just available for organizations, but now they've opened it up and made it available to individuals to have play with. So I want to play with it, I just haven't. The last 5 years I've been studying a law degree, so that's taken up a lot of my time. But in terms of MuseScore and SoundMyBraille and even Duxbury, to a point, you can certainly write music in Duxbury. It doesn't really understand it, but you can write it. I really like MuseScore. I like where it's going. I think it's fantastic that it has Braille. SoundMyBraille editor is fantastic because it's free. The only piece of software you didn't touch on was BME, Braille Music Editor. Now, I looked into this many years ago, and I remember looking at it thinking, wow, this is really interesting. Because you can Braille in, and it would speak the notes, it would play them, and it was pretty cool. The only thing you couldn't do was print. If you wanted to like have a print version of your score, how I used to do it was the old fashioned way of just sitting there dictating it to someone who felt like they could write it. But speaking of Goodfeel, Dancing Dots did some other software, which was Cake Talking, which was for Cakewalk Sonar back in the day. But they also did a package for Sibelius, the famous music software from Abu. It was called Sibelius Speak. It was pretty amazing. Back in the day, if you wanted it to work really well, you had to use specific configuration of JAWS and versions and graphics cards and all sorts of screen settings, but it did work. It worked really well. And that was how I did a lot of my music, especially in uni anyway. But in the end, the main things that I did, I would either pay someone or get a friend to write it out, because although it was good back then, it just wasn't what it should be. You couldn't necessarily hand it in for professional work. But now I think we're at that point almost. MakeBraille certainly has promise. MuseScore I think is just fantastic. There's just so much potential with that. There's a lot of sighted people who are even switching away from the big programs like Sibelius and stuff and even switching to MuseScore because it's free and it's pretty good. So that's really cool.
And what I like about this is that we're now at a point where even if it's not perfect, we have enough tools that we can do a reasonable job of kind of working it out. It's kind of like where OCR technology is for print. I could ask the organ scholar at the cathedral to produce me a music XML file of a piece of music. He could do that in whatever program he wanted. He could send me a music XML file of a piece of music that we're singing at the cathedral. I could bring that into SoundMy and emboss it. And it may not come out perfectly, but it would come out well enough that I could read it. And if there was a bit that I couldn't read, I could import it into MuseScore and I could listen to it. And I could go, ah, that's what he meant. He just put this in a slightly strange way. And then I could go and edit the music XML file to fix that and then run it through SoundMyBraille again and get another Braille copy out. Or even just get to a point where, okay, I've got it near enough. I'll just make a BRF file and edit the BRF file by hand. But we are at a point now where if we need to be able to produce our own music, we can do it. And I think that's really quite incredible that we've come this far in such a short space of time.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, Sibelius Speaking was around in 2004, 2005, maybe a bit earlier. And it's now 20 years later, and we're at the point where we can independently create our own Braille stuff. And that's not to say that transcribers aren't still needed. We had a wonderful transcriber in Australia, the late John Shute, OAM. who brailled, I think, 30,000 pages from memory in this huge catalogue that he started brailing in about 98 and finished in probably early 2014. So it's a huge amount of material. A lot of it is specific to specific people, but that's a wonderful resource, and it just shows that transcribers are still needed. But the fact that we have these options now means that if we are stuck, we can certainly use it as a fallback mechanism. I mean, I don't think transcribers will be replaced anytime soon, despite the technology, because music's so specialized, and other codes like maths and stuff like that are so specialized, you need those transcribers that know that thing. So although we're talking about all this technology, which is amazing, there are still times where, like, I don't know if I'd get an XML file of a piece by list, for instance. So I think I'd get that braille.
And it's time consuming. I mean, even if you did get it and you read it and you found errors, by the time you've gone through and fixed all the errors, it's much better just to pay someone to do the work for you. But still, to be able to produce braille scores from print, and indeed to be able to produce print scores from braille to a point. I mean, you can braille into MuseScore now. You can certainly, when you're in MuseScore and doing step editing, you know, where you say these are the notes that are quavers and these are the notes that are crotchets, to be able to see that in braille, I just think it levels the playing field.
That's wonderful. It really is wonderful. I just wish you could see more than one bar at a time in braille, but they have to start somewhere. So I see only good things coming.
We've been skirting around braille technology for most of this interview in one way or another. And I think I'd really like to turn my attention to this now and really focus in on it. You studied music when you left school, and then, I don't really know, but you landed in the technology industry, and not necessarily in the braille technology industry. Harking back to the start of the interview, as we first met in 2008, you were working for a company called TNT Consultancy, which sadly is now no longer in operation. And now you're not really working in music or technology or anything, but technology is such a huge part of what you do. Perhaps talk us through that journey a bit, and the braille technology in particular that you're using, and how those career paths intersect.
At the end of school, I got my first braille note. I got it at Christmas 2002, I remember. I wasn't as rich as some of the other people and couldn't afford a 32 cell, so I had an 18 cell. And that got me through pretty much my entire uni degree. And that was the Braille Note Classic. While I was at uni, the Braille Note Empower came out. And Freedom Scientific were doing their PacMage. But after uni, I wanted to do something with tech. I'd been really interested in it. And TNT approached me in 2007. And they said, we'd like to set up an Australian of our business to get our software into Australia, such as JSA and things like that that they sold. So Terry Clasper, Tracy Clasper, and Tracy Caulfield came out from the UK and they set up the Australian arm. It was me and my dad. So my dad was just keeping an eye on the books to make sure I wasn't spending the corporate credit card on a new piano or a new braille display that I wasn't meant to get. I did all the training and tech support. And in October of 2007, I went to the UK for a couple of weeks and I met Brian Hartchen, who's still around, obviously running his own company now. So yeah, I got really into the braille technology over the years, and I ran TNT probably till early 2010. And then we closed that down. I went to New York for 6.5 weeks and came back and got a job with Quantum Reading Learning Vision, which back then was actually Quantum Technology. While I worked there, they rebranded to Quantum Reading Learning Vision. I was in charge of working with products like the PacMate, the Focus 40, the Alva BC640. I don't know if you remember that from Optilec. It was very expensive, but for those who could get it, it was a pretty interesting device. Them and Handytech always have really interesting displays. So I worked at Quantum for about 18 months and then moved on to Pacific Vision. Pacific Vision in Australia sell the HIMS line of products, so the Braille Sense and now the eMotion. I worked there for about 3 years, mainly selling the Braille Sense U2. That was extremely popular in Australia. After that, I did a bit of a stint at Vision Australia as a trainer. And then I went to the Royal Institute for Deaf and Blind Children. After that, I got a job at Humanware just as they were about to launch their Braille Note Touch. the original Brownlow touch. And that was fascinating. I did a tour of Asia, which was 5 countries in 12 days. That taught me a lot. I did presentations where they had interpreters, so you had to obviously adapt your presentation to the interpreter and to the different questions that were asked, and it was quite interesting. And then I worked at Guide Dogs for a while, and then I ended up where I am now, which is the National Disability Insurance Agency, which is the agency that looks after the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which, in like a real quick summary, it's a scheme for people in Australia that have a permanent disability, and they can get things like technology, support, therapies, orientation, mobility, guide dogs, various things like that. And I'm a planner in there, so I build participant plans to make sure that the people have the support they need. I couldn't do any of this without Braille, and this leads me back to a point I made earlier. Literacy is the key to success, and Braille is the key to our success. So I do have a large Braille display collection, and it's not that I necessarily like collecting Braille displays. I think different use cases warrant different displays or note takers, depending on what you want to use for the situation.
Yes, I've been in this position where I thought, well, it wouldn't be wonderful if you could get this feature of this Braille display and pair it with this feature of this Braille display, and then you would have the perfect Braille display. But it seems to me like we haven't got the perfect Braille display. And that disappoints me. Offline, we've talked about, for example, the Focus versus the Brailliant. And it's no surprise that I think the Brailliant Braille is better than the Focus Braille. And yet I absolutely love typing on the Focus keyboard, and I love the controls on the Focus. So where does this leave people who just want to buy a Braille display? They've only got the money for one Braille display. How do you choose which Braille display is the best one for them?
I think this comes back to making sure that you can get the opportunity to look at the Braille displays. And by look at, I don't mean just 5 minutes with one display. I mean, to be able to have a display for a week or 10 days or 2 weeks, it makes a huge difference. You can set it up, you can try it with your own use case and go, okay, this display is lovely, or actually it's not going to work for me because I don't find thumb keys work, or I don't find the scroll buttons work the way I want them to work. It's a personal preference thing, and you can't figure that out from 5 minutes. So I think demos and trials are crucial. And I know it's not always easy, because some people might be in areas where the companies aren't, or they just can't get to places where Braille displays are. But that's up to you to negotiate with the company and say, listen, I'm willing to part with my money if you're willing to give me a trial or a demo. It really is important to be able to look at the displays, because there's nothing worse than buying something unseen. And if you get it and you hate it, then you've spent $4,000+ of your own money that sometimes can take a long time to get, particularly if you're not working. And we know a lot of our community do struggle to find employment. And it's really important to know that what you are getting is right.
There's been a bit of a blurring of the lines in recent years, in particular, as more and more companies have come out with smart Braille displays. And I've flip-flopped about this. There are times when I think that a smart Braille display is really good. And there are other times when I think, yeah, but the problem is the smart Braille display isn't quite smart enough. And so I still need a note taker for the things that the smart Braille display can't do. And so I end up using the smart Braille display like a dumb Braille display. Where do you stand on this whole issue?
I still use note takers because I believe there is a place for them. I use the Braille Sense Mini and the Braille Sense 32, depending on what I'm doing. Mainly the Mini, because I love the compact size. It's lovely to be able to put something in your bag and to just have it there to read. It's 20 cells, so it's still decent Braille length. There's the 20 cell Brailleant, which is nice, and it's got some features. But the keyboard for me isn't amazing. I'll be honest, the keyboard on the Brailleant displays, I'm not a huge fan of. I love the Braille, I love the fluent reading and everything, but the keyboard itself, it feels like it's just, it needs more depth. And whereas the keyboard on the Focus, like you say, is amazing. Sometimes it's really nice just to have a device that will connect to, say, Dropbox or Google Drive or something, without you having to use your phone. I think a phone is very important and it's great to have those skills. But sometimes you literally just don't want to worry about the connectivity and all that. You just want to be able to get something done with as fewer keystrokes as possible.
And it's not even just about the keystrokes for me. It's about the whole reading experience. I want to open a Word document from Dropbox and I want it to read as closely as possible to reading a Braille book. I don't want things to get in the way. I don't want my screen to lock accidentally and then I've got to unlock the screen and I might have lost focus and all of this. I just want to read it. And I don't feel like the iPhone or any sort of technology really has got there yet in the same way that a note taker has.
No, they haven't. And that's not to say they're not good. I mean, Apple are doing some pretty innovative things. But I couldn't imagine, for instance, connecting my Braille display to my phone, going to notes and typing some music, because it'll just look weird and it just wouldn't work. In terms of smart Braille displays, I think the display at the moment that's got everybody interested is the Emotion from Hims. As soon as I saw it, I got one. The keyboard seems almost like the Focus keyboard. So if the next iteration of the Braillian, if we could have that, that would be nice. Now, I use the Braillian for work, but the Emotion is kind of that hybrid thing where they've ported the notepad from the Braille Sense straight to the Emotion. So you've got all the same commands. You can't print, but you can type in the notepad. You've also got a few other things as well. You've got the media player. Now, for that, I think that's really ingenious because you can be reading or writing notes and you can be listening to, say, a uni lecture or something, and you can just pause it and you can be writing your notes and then save a Word document, copy it to your computer and do the final formatting and editing on PC. Note takers, you can put very basic formatting in, but if you want to do proper formatting, you have to use it PC. What I'd like to see with the Emotion is the Dropbox integration or the Google Drive integration or both, because I think of the Emotion as a cut-down version of the Braille Sense. I don't think of the Braillian as a note-taker because keypad and a Braille editor and things like that, and they work pretty well. They do have limits on the file sizes you can open, and I haven't found a limit on the Emotion. And that's not to pit the companies against each other. Both of them, Humeware and Hims, do amazing work, and also so does Freedom Scientific, their displays. But I think it goes back to what I was saying before about getting your hands on the displays and really being able to try out the features for your own use case. And I think that's a real key. Features like email and stuff are sort of nice to have, but I wouldn't want that on a Braille display because, you know, I'll just connect it to my computer for that or my phone or something. But on the note taker, it's kind of nice to just flick through your emails and go, okay, I can really read this in Braille and I can respond in Braille.
Okay, so you are actually a Braille first email person. I never have been. I've always done email on the computer and I've always found email really clunky in Braille for some reason. I've just never really felt the need to read emails in Braille.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I think it depends what it is. Obviously, it's quicker reading them in speech and over with them in speech, but if I'm writing big long emails and stuff, say, you know, I'm writing to my boss, I'm writing a business case for someone or for something that I need or want, I'm going to look at that in Braille because I want to make sure that it makes sense, it's clear, and obviously, sure, I can type, and that's fine, but I'm one of these people that if I'm going to read in Braille, I want to be able to write in Braille as well. The Mantis, it's a cool display, but it's nice to write in Braille. It gives you that sense of power, and not only that, you can write really quickly because you write in contraction.
No, I can see that, and there are definitely times when I've been surprised by how I felt about something. When I first got the Braille Sense 6, I thought, I'll do Zoom calls on it and I'll do Teams calls on it. And I just really did it for a laugh. I thought, this is a bit of a gimmick, really, you know, installing these apps from the Play Store. I'll never actually do it, but it would just be fun to see if it can do it. But actually, that is a really nice experience because you can do everything in Braille. You can turn the speech off and you can be in a meeting and you can be browsing the chat in Braille and you can find the mute button really easily because it's got first letter navigation and it's even got a global mute toggle now. Do you find yourself using those sorts of productivity tools on a note taker?
Oh, I do, because it'd be quiet. You're not having to have your speech read out. I use speech a lot too, but Braille for me is really just the way of reading and taking information in. I think the important thing is it's about making it fit into your workflow.
Yeah, entirely that. And I think one of the things I really like about it is the lack of clutter. A question that I quite often get asked is, why is Braille on Windows just not good? I don't know how you feel about Braille on Windows. I always feel like Braille on Windows is getting there. It does kind of work, but it just feels like there's something missing from it. And I wonder whether the something missing from it is Windows itself is so cluttered. It takes so long to actually find the information that you want. Whereas even in a Play Store app, it's one flat screen. And so the amount of clutter is significantly less.
That's right. I mean, even Braille on iOS isn't amazing, unfortunately. It's okay, but there's still issues with Braille input. Apple have been working on it for years. I'm certainly happy that they've done it because it's a huge booster, particularly for people who are deafblind and people who just want to use Braille. But I would much rather use my note taker to take notes than connect my phone to my Braille display and then have the connection drop out. Though it's getting a bit less now that it does that. The eMotion, going back to that, is quite interesting because a lot of the new displays that have come out now have the HID standard. HIMWARE, I know, went all in on the HID standard, so Brailliant won't connect to anything that isn't HID, whereas the eMotion, you can connect to devices that aren't HID compliant and it will still work. So I think that's a good thing for them. Also, the Braille Sense will connect to the Braille display. So if you've got nothing else except a note taker, you can do that. And I think the other thing to remember is a lot of these devices, they're very light to carry around. And I think there are people that sometimes want multiple displays, like one at the office and one at home. And it's like, well, they're actually not that bad. I mean, laptops these days are pretty small. Braille displays is nice and small. They're a lot more compact than they used to be.
Easier to carry around and also easier to connect and disconnect, actually on Bluetooth and USB. There was a time when you really just wouldn't want to carry a Braille display around and connect it to multiple machines, even if it was portable, because USB would break or Bluetooth would break. And I feel like that happens a bit less now.
It does. It still happens occasionally, particularly with some screen readers more than others. And it's hard to know sometimes, is it the screen reader? Is it the computer? Is it the operating system? There's challenges there, but I think it's just about getting that balance. I don't think note takers are going away. A lot of people say, oh, why would you get a note taker? Because the operating system is out of date. But the thing is, it doesn't matter necessarily what Braille Sense is running if the apps are going to do what they say they do. Obviously, we still want to be able to install apps. And that's a challenge from what I understand. HIMS aren't a huge company like Apple and Microsoft and Google. And that's the same with HIMWARE, the same with Freedom Scientific as well. So I think it's a case of just dealing with what you've got.
Yeah, that's true. There are equally reasons why actually it does matter. There comes a point where the Android version is so old that, as you say, you can't install apps anymore. Or if you want to enroll the device in mobile device management so you can use work-based emails and stuff like that. So actually the Android version does matter, at least to that extent.
That's why I was saying you don't want to be any further back than, say, two or three versions behind, because that way you're protected by that. Because there are still phones out there that are still running Android 11 or 12.
So far, we've talked about the smaller displays, actually. We've talked about the eMotion, which is a 40-cell display, and various displays that are smaller than that. What's your take on displays that are bigger than that, and in particular the 80-cell displays, of which there aren't many, but there are a couple?
80 cells are for a really specific market, I think. If it was two lines underneath each other, that would be nice. Two lines of 40 or four lines of 20. But that one big line, find that sometimes you just stop reading because you think, oh, I've read, oh, no, hang on, there's more over here. So I think, while it's nice to have, it's not something I would necessarily say to someone, yeah, get an 80. You would really want to try it and know that you needed it for what you were doing.
See, I'm like that too. I don't like the scratch pad on the Focus 80 because you just end up with long, long lines. I find on Windows it's surprisingly helpful. There's been a few things I've been surprised about with Braille displays recently, and how well I've taken to an 80 cell is one of those. Actually, not in terms of the line length, which is quite long, but in terms of because you've got a long line length, you can afford to have the status cells on. You can afford to have the dialogue box title on the Braille display, and you still have a good chunk of Braille display left to show the text of the control that you're currently in. And I find that quite helpful in terms of Windows and Braille.
That is very helpful. And that leads us into that wonderful new feature of yours, Split Braille. And the 80 cell is perfect for Split Braille. You can read different parts of the screen and navigate them independently. And I think that was fantastic during my degree, because I would be looking at part of the document on one side and my notes on the other. I think Sparrow really did a good job with that. Maybe they might refine the feature a little bit, but I'm not really sure what else you could do with it.
No, other than add more views. And it's amazing, actually, when you think about it, what views you can have. Clearly, a lot of creativity has gone into this. I quite like the view, for example, where you can be in Outlook and you have the message list on one side and you have the preview pane on the other. And I mean, who would have thought to have done that? But whoever thought of it is an absolute genius.
It's a great feature. It really is. But you have to have a display that supports it. The Focus supports it. Braille supports it. The eMotion supports it now.
And when we talk about supporting it, we're not just talking about supporting the split. I mean, I think actually even Braille displays which don't technically support it, you can still actually split the display. I mean, I got Split Braille to work on a BrailleSense 6, you know, with a 32-cell display. The split was very strange, but the real problem I had was that I could only control the left-hand side of the display. I couldn't control the right-hand side. There's been a lot of work done under the hood to say when we're not in Split Braille, so the thumb keys of the Brailleant have to do one thing, whereas when we are in Split Braille, those thumb keys have to do another thing. We've had in the UK and in the rest of the English-speaking world a tendency to think about the Freedom products, the Humanware products, and the HIMSS products. And those are kind of the three products that we think about, you know, BrailleNote, BrailleSense, and PackMate, or Focus, Brailleant, and eMotion. And all of these products are great in their own way. There's a whole heap of others, though. Have you had chance to see many of those devices? And why do you think they're just not taking off in the English-speaking world as much as they perhaps deserve to?
I think it's purely and simply what's popular. It's also what gets brought in. In Australia, we get very specific items brought in. Like, for example, the activator. Over here, it's about $10,000. So it's a lot of money. And part of it is they don't keep them in stock. Once you order it, they order it in for you. Whereas if you go and order an eMotion or a BrailleSense 6 or a Focus or a Brailleant, in some cases, you'll get it the next day. Part of it's also just knowing that they exist. In some cases, some of these companies will order them in if you can convince them that it's worth it. Like the Visio Braille stuff, they're really ingenious because you can get Braille displays that are just powered by USB. They don't have any battery or anything, and you just plug them in and off you go. There's even an 80 cell one that's just powered literally by a USB port on your laptop. And I think that's really cool for something if you just want to throw it in your bag and take a 40 cell display with you and not have to worry about charging it or anything like that.
Yeah, and it's just about really getting momentum up, isn't it? As much as, yeah, people need to know about them, but then people need to be comfortable and confident that they will actually do what you think they will do.
And I think it's also another big thing is support. Humanware, HIMSS, and Bisparo have a huge network of dealers and distributors around the world, so you can get local support. Now, I'm not saying you're not going to get that with some of these other displays, but with some of them, you're on your own. Something happens, you've got to send it back, you've got to deal with it. So if you're willing to take that risk, sure. But I think that's also why a lot of these people go with these organizations.
Well, Scott, this has been fascinating. I do just want to ask you, I guess multi-line Braille must be the next step in Braille innovation. What do you think? There's the Monarch, there's the Canute, there's the Dot Pad.
And there's the Orbit Slate. I really like what's being done. I wish the Monarch was 40 cells rather than 32. So in other words, 10 lines of 40 rather than 10 lines of 32. But I can see why they didn't, because it would just be huge. And obviously they had to focus on weight and various other things and battery life and all that sort of thing. I think the Monarch's going to take off. They had to have a version one, so the price was always going to be expensive. It's obviously aimed at education because it's designed to help with textbooks and things like that. But I think once it works for screen readers, that's going to be the time when people are going to look at it who aren't just students wanting to read textbook. I think the price is going to make it prohibitive outside the US. I'm not sure in the UK, but I know here it's going to be about $26,000 or $27,000, which is really out of people's ranges. And given it's marketed education, I'm not sure funding will really happen. And that's not to discourage people from looking at it. It's just reality of version one of something brand new is always going to be interesting. But I think EPRF, the work that's being done on that book, help Monarch as well.
Well, Scott, this has been a brilliant interview. Thank you for your time and thank you for all of your insights into the world of Braille. And I'm sure this will not be the last time we speak to you. So maybe in a few years' time, we'll catch up with you again. But for now, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Braillecast, the official podcast of the Braillists Foundation. You can find more Braille-related content by subscribing to Braillecast, all one word, in your podcast client of choice, or listening to Braillecast, connecting the dots for Braillists everywhere on your smart speaker. You can also find past episodes on our website at braillecast.com. If you have comments on the podcast or suggestions of topics or guests for future episodes, please email help@braillists.org. You can also find the Braillists on X, formerly Twitter, at Braillists, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Braillists Foundation. If you'd like to make a financial contribution to Braillecast, please consider making a donation to the Braillists Foundation at braillists.org/donate. Finally, if you know other people who are interested in Braille, please tell them where to find us. Until next time, on behalf of everyone on the Braillecast team, thanks for listening, and bye for now. The costs of producing this episode were defrayed by a resilience grant from the Social Impact Fund of the Vision Foundation and Fight for Sight. For more information, visit visionfoundation.org.uk.